plays the piano himself.
Twin Cities News Talk. Justice and Drew, along with Sam.
Get ready, boys.
Who's very enamored by St. Paul Mayor Melvin Carter.
Black Mayor brings emotions to every resident.
It's just like Hamilton.
The teachers, the doctors, the children.
Should be on Broadway.
And police union president.
Sounds like Aaron Burr.
Kind of does.
The sun is shining locally.
Actually does have
it's stormy and
pretty
DC.
Good voice.
Thank
not gonna
you.
Lie.
Thank you. And he's playing
we're
the piano.
We're gonna prove our country still.
He should stick to that.
Scrappy and hungry like me.
Are you ready for it?
Your brown-eyed mare.
I get it.
I am your brown-eyed mare.
So what I appreciated about his performance at Minros, though, was...
I hate Minros so much.
I mean, 92,
much.
But what I appreciated about his performance was the fact that, so you compare it to, like, Jacob Fry, his performance was just, like, ooh, it's just... pretentiousness,
sure,
and he just
sure.
came off as a total tool. And I feel like Melvin Carter, while I don't necessarily agree with him politically, obviously, I feel like he was able to do this performance, and it was kind of like funny or whatever, sort of.
It's
in a way.
Little better.
That's what I'm saying. I'm comparing the two, and that's what I was saying yesterday. I wasn't just like obsessing about it, but like when you compare it to Jacob Fry, who just comes off really gross. He was able to do this bit with Minros, and like it was much, much, much better than how Jacob Fry came across. See, just this. Here's Jacob Fry.
You're kind of young.
You're kind of dumb.
You're not from Minnesota.
Please go away.
And we think your Superman Jeez. Curl is fake.
It probably is.
You twirled it that way.
You said the word hungin.
That was dumb.
Talking about the fans from Philly. We liked the old name for that lake.
Because we did.
Fans.
We have no fans.
Jacob fans.
Literally no fans.
Reaching out.
Nobody's reaching out to you.
Consensually touching you. I'm Jacob Fry. No, it's not pronounced like Frey. Sarah's my bride. I know you probably thought I'm gay.
Are you guys familiar? You're familiar. I know Drew is.
He just comes off so pretentious.
Are you familiar with The Office, Sam? You watch the show?
Yes.
Okay. So later in The Office, it's top of mind because we just finished up watching the entire all the seasons again. Both Jacob Fry and St. Paul Mayor Melvin Carter, they need to go the Andy route and they need to quit their day jobs and go pursue their dreams. They need to go be singers.
Go on The Voice.
Yeah, go on The Voice. Yeah. Go on whatever audition. Incarnation of American Idol is out there right now. Get out of the governing business.
Naked and Afraid or whatever reality show you want to be on.
Pioneer Press. St. Paul Mayor Melvin Carter is setting up a task force, and they need one because there's a lot of questions to establish children's savings accounts. A 30-member group will be co-chaired by Ann Mulholland, Vice President of Community Impact at St. Paul and Minnesota Community Foundations, along with the President of Sunrise Banks, as well as a St. Paul City Council member. The task force will handle community engagement, setting up the program, and will offer funding and implementation recommendations. Carter mentioned establishing $50 savings accounts for St. Paul children during his campaign. A number of other U.S. cities have adopted similar programs as a way to help provide college funds for children. This is where the truest statement he could have made. Carter said this. Letting our children know we believe in their potential is a priceless investment. Well, no, it's not priceless because you're
okay. Then just do that. If that's the case, if that's a priceless investment, then go around to every child, one by one.
Yep.
I just am Mayor Melvin Carter. I'd like to let your children know I believe in their potential.
He could do a traveling roadshow with his piano.
Just do that. That's free.
He should do that. He should. He should try to do a traveling roadshow.
The task force will work with officials from areas such as colleges, businesses, banks, birth centers, and community organizations. The task force will meet twice a month, is expected to present recommendations to the mayor and the city council in January of next year. So, look, there's a lot of questions here. First off, you know, when does this end, by the way? Okay, so you're setting up this $50 savings account. So what's next, you know, after that? Okay. I mean, you're going to end up trying to push for free college? Are we going to end up going St. Paul guaranteed job Bernie Sanders route?
Why not?
Right?
Why not? Government can do anything, John. It can solve
I don't believe you.
It can solve all of society's ills. It can fix anything. It can do anything, all with other people's money. It's fine. I mean, it's no personal sacrifice on his part, so why not?
I wrote down a list of potential questions for the task force, okay?
Oh, I can't wait for this proposal to get some legs.
So do you get like a Visa gift card at birth? Is that how that works? Or do you get like a certificate and a savings account with $50 in it has been set up in your name? Okay. What if you just had a child and then you moved into, you know, Ramsey County? Mm-hmm. So what if do you get it, or do you get like a
right? Is it provisional?
Yeah, is it prorated?
Born in Ramsey County limits.
What if you had a kid and then you move away? Can you cash out?
Are you even allowed to? Or do you lose it? Do you forfeit it?
What if you moved away and then came back after having a child?
Does it vest over a period of time?
What if you adopt?
Ooh, that's a good question.
So are they going to be, you know, are they? What if
the child is born out of wedlock? Because I'm sure there's going to be some stewardship for the parents.
Right.
You know, like they will have some control over this. So who gets custody of the savings account?
Is there a cutoff? What's the cutoff age for, you know, like if you move in, is there a cutoff age for an, you know, your kid's got to be a certain age? Is there
like, move to St. Paul. Is to get that savings account.
Is there a limit per household? I just out of curiosity.
Can you cap out? What bank is this guy? Are they going to work with? Because I'm sure there's going to be societal implications. Like it can't be, you know, one of the big banks, you know, because they've got problematic issues there.
Well, I think it's one of the members of the 30 member group task force is the president of Sunrise Bank. So why is Sunrise Banks suddenly now got the upper hand in all of this? And who did they support during the last election cycle? Just out of, you know, look, all you're doing is stunting growth potential for individuals. It's all style over substance. This idea. I have a better idea. It's simple. Real easy. Why don't you figure out the amount sort of per year on the average? I did some Googling this morning, like looking at the births and like some 6,000 some odd births, depending on, you know, what numbers you're looking at in Ramsey County. So like a dollar amount isn't so, I mean, it's big, but it's not so, we're not talking about $10 million, right? But why don't you just start a nonprofit, or at a bare minimum, just start a GoFundMe campaign in St. Paul, and just say, hey, community, we need X amount of money, which would be the equivalent of $50 for every single child born in St. Paul, and just do it that way. That's all community-based.
And he doesn't get credit, John.
Well, he can be the one that said it. It can be the St. Paul Mayor Melvin Carter GoFundMe Childhood Savings Account campaign.
That's not his
name on it.
That's not a government solution.
But he's with the government.
First of all, is this even a problem? I mean, are there people out there lamenting the lack of savings account for babies? You know, every day a child is born without a savings account.
Yeah, I just saw a Sarah McLachlan ad.
for just the price of a cup of coffee. Right. You can help ensure that every child born in St. Paul.
Oh, that's a better way. Do it like the adopt account. A St. Paul baby.
Like you can visit it.
Yeah, it's right. Oh, it's so much closer. You could actually meet the child. You could you for pennies a day for less.
Can adopt a St. Paul.
Yes. Oh, it's brilliant. For less the price of a cup of coffee a day.
I mean, they live in St. Paul.
You can they really adopt need a your St. help. Paul. You can support a St. Paul baby. That's fantastic. Can we beat him to the punch? Let's start our own campaign. Oh yeah,
St. Paul baby.
Yeah. Sam, you wanna pull in? We could all adopt the St. Paul baby together.
It'll be really successful if you can throw in a parking spot.
That's true.
That is true. You know, if I could get a parking spot
maybe. Out of it, I'd do it. Yeah. I would adopt a St. Paul baby.
That mentality. It's so wrong. It's so wrong on every single level.
Such a dumb idea.
651-989-5855. Speaking of dumb ideas, Adam Bloomberg, and this relates to St. Paul, because Melvin Carter recently said, and Drew, correct me if I'm wrong on this, he said that when it comes to the $15 minimum wage, it wasn't a matter of if, it's just a matter of when. They basically decided they're going to implement this. Right now, the only, I think, sticking point is the tip credit. We do have some rather interesting data that's coming out of Seattle from Bloomberg. Seattle's painful lesson on the road to a $15 minimum wage. The experiment has hurt low-wage workers, cutting their earnings by $125 a month.
Yeah, this isn't the first time we've seen numbers like this. Washington Post did a similar piece a few years ago, and this is just updated information.
The city of Seattle, to its credit, actually made some effort to chart the waters as they went along, starting back in 2014, funding an ideologically diverse research team at the University of Washington. So since the law raised the wage in stages, they studied it in stages, and that's what's really key about this. The results of the first jump, from $9.47 to $11 an hour, they were released last year and seemed to show that the effects on earnings were pretty small. Okay. There was an increase of about $72 every 3 months, and that low wage unemployment declined slightly. Okay. So the paper didn't really offer ammunition for either side. So that was from $9.47 to $11. So you had a slight dip in employment, but you did have an increase of about $72. Okay. The University of Washington is not the only studying the Seattle experiment. The last week, a report came from UC Berkeley focused on food services. That study reported, our results show that wages in food services did increase, indicating the policy achieved its goal. Employment in food service, however, was not affected, even among the limited service restaurants, many of them franchises, for whom the policy was binding. Seattle Mayor Ed Murray seemed ecstatic by the news. Now, the new data gives ammunition to the mayor's opposition. The University of Washington released its second study. This one covered the jump from $11 to $13, and that study found huge effects. For every 1% increase in the hourly wage, low-wage workers saw a 3% reduction in the number of hours worked, and as a result, they lost $125 in earnings a month, clawing back the entire gain from the earlier hike and more.
And you know who doesn't care? Seattle's mayor and every politician who advocated and pushed for this, and all the union organizations and community organizations and political groups that advocated and pushed for this increased minimum wage. They don't care, because this is not about those low-wage workers.
Right, right. And that's sad. I mean, it really is. It really is sad. And it's sad that all those activists out there pushing this, getting so many, duping, lying to people. That's really what happens. They're lying to people.
Yep.
Saying that they're going to come and help them. They're going to get them the wages they deserve. But the reality is, nope, it's all, again, completely self-serving, trying to push their own ideologies, and it actually hurts them. You get towards the end of the piece here. For as the authors note, the first round of hikes had relatively small impacts, while the second round had huge ones, suggesting the effects might be non-linear It makes sense. Relatively few people in this country make the minimum wage, so a small increase doesn't make much difference to most workers or employers. But a large jump affects more people. And the wage increases are much bigger for the lowest paid staffers. So if you make $9 an hour, but generate $10.50 in revenue for your boss, a law that raises the wage to $10.45 may cause her to shrug and decide it's easier to keep you on as long as she's making something. But a wage that forces her to pay you far more than you bring in.
Right. More than you're worth.
Continuing to employ would be bad business.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what this is doing. These minimum wage increases that we're seeing in Seattle, that we're seeing in St. Paul, Minneapolis, they are forcing employers to pay employees more than they're worth. That's a losing proposition. Anytime you do that, you know, you're eventually just going to have to rework your entire employment structure, have less employees, and make those employees do more, or you're just going to go out of business. You can't afford to pay people more than they're worth and continue to stay in business.
This makes me laugh. They say at some level we all intuitively understood that this was true. If the minimum wage increases by a penny an hour, probably even the most rock-ribbed conservatives would not predict mass firings. On the other hand, if the wage was arbitrarily set at $100 an hour, even ardent labor activists would presumably expect widespread unemployment to follow. You can't flat out say minimum wages don't increase unemployment, because the size of the increase and the level of the resulting wage obviously matter at some margin. Seattle may have discovered that margin, and unfortunately, it may yet discover it even further, uglier margins, when the data is in on the full increase to $15 an hour. That's the danger of striking out for uncharted territories. Sometimes you end up where there be dragons. You know, and they set it up this way. This is what's so nefarious about this whole thing. They set it up this way intentionally. They do the small increases because by the time it actually reaches the point that they won at $15 an hour, the damage will have been spread out over a long enough timeline where they don't have to hear about it, right? Those individuals that are largely affected, they'll have gone off, lost their jobs, found other things to go do. Unfortunately, they will have lost their gigs. Yeah. None of what they wanted to accomplish would have been accomplished, and they can sit back going, we did something great. We have a $15 flat minimum wage now.
And nobody's even thinking about, you know, what's going to happen in just a few years. You've got a bunch of, you know, 12 to 15-year-olds right now who are going to be entering that job market in the next few years, looking for their first job, looking for those entry-level positions, looking to make a little extra money over the summer or on weekends and things like that. They are going to be really hard pressed to find any job,
right?
Because I'm sorry, but there ain't a 15 or 16 year old out there right now that has a skill set that's worth $15 an hour.
These are necessary jobs for those young kids too. I mean, I got my 15 year old that I'm looking to go get a, you know, a gig coming up, you know, soon. And it's like, how many of these jobs are going to be available? They're going to be willing to go and hire some brand new, you know, high school kid when the wage is $15 an hour. 651-989-5855. Coming up, got a Gone Green update. Climate skeptics are more eco-friendly than global warming alarmists.
It's a shame it's going to go get burned after the show.
See, it's like this song. You ought to be having fun. We're just having fun here on Twin Cities News Talk.
Fun.
What? When did
such
it turn?
Fun.
When did the laughter die, Sam? We were trucking along fine. Suddenly now she's on, did we miss
oh, no,
something
when you started
in there?
Making fun of my face in the picture.
I wasn't making fun of your face in the picture. Use it.
No. I'm fine with making fun of the clothes.
No,
you're making fun of my face.
I wasn't making fun of your face.
Your face is fine. There's nothing wrong with your face that,
everybody,
you know,
use
that
the
average
TCNT.
Observer can't see.
Use the hashtag TCNT to light up these two because they're picking on me now.
No, all I said was that the way you took the picture was like you were lunging. It's like, cultural appropriation.
Kind of, yeah, I'm lunging towards you to come and beat you up, John.
You're leading.
Exactly. Specifically you.
It looked like you were like, I'm going to have you for dinner.
Literally just tilted my head. Oh, my Lord. I'm never coming back.
You know what? This makes me feel so good because all three of us, like, do not take it well. And that makes me happy.
I take it fine. fine.
I know that I don't, but it does give me a certain sense of horrible joy that on occasion you guys don't take it when it goes your way either all that well. So I just you know,
I take it just fine. I take it better than any of you guys. Sometimes.
Totally.
Clearly.
Pete Hegseth can join us just after 8:30. One more Seattle story before we move on to how, if you believe in global warming, you're actually killing the planet. out of Reason.com, Seattle may hit peak progressivism with its literal tax on jobs.
Yeah, this is insane. Seattle has completely lost their minds. They're preparing to tax, to pass a literal tax on jobs. It's an employee head tax, which would impose a 26-cent levy on every hour worked by an employee. A company's making more than $20 million a year. That tax would hit between 500 and 600 businesses, and it's designed to raise money for homelessness and affordable housing services.
Yeah, they have a homeless problem, so instead they decided to just go ahead and tax businesses that make a lot of money per employee to fix it. You guys will fix the problem for us by throwing money at it.
You guys make so much money. Why don't you give us money for everybody you hire? Just give us money for every person that employs you for no other reason than there's a person that you've hired that you're paying. Now that person is going to cost you this much more, you know, per month, and you just have to give it to us.
Yeah, I mean,
it's insane. You want to talk about, you know, slowing down commerce, slowing down the economy? You know, you tax behaviors that you want to see decrease, right?
Well, maybe they want to see people fired. Maybe that's what it is.
They certainly want to see less people hired.
Amazon is not taking it lying down because it's been nicknamed the Amazon tax. Of that $75 million in revenue, $20 million is expected to come from the online retailer. On Tuesday, the company announced that it was pausing construction planning for the 17-story building intended to serve as office space for some 7,000 Amazon employees. They said, "I can confirm that pending the outcome of the head tax vote by the city council, Amazon has paused all construction planning on our Block 18 project in downtown Seattle and is evaluating options to sublease all space in our recently leased Rainier Square building." It is simply, you make a lot of money and we want some of that.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah, the government, the politicians pushed back where they were incensed at this reaction to a totally predictable consequence of their policy. Councilmember Mike O'Brien says, "If Amazon generally wants to engage about how they can be part of the solution, we welcome that conversation. But we need companies that are profitable and making billions of dollars every year to help with the folks that are being forced out of housing and ending up on the street." Then they've got the self-proclaimed socialist who is a hero here in Minneapolis, right? This Kashama Sawant, who is on the council. She called the Amazon's reaction to what they're proposing blackmail. It's called blackmail. They're trying to blackmail us. No. They're simply reacting to the policies that you're putting in place. You want 26 cents for every person they hire, for every employee they have, for no good reason. You just want them to give it to you, and you expect them to just lie down and take it?
You mean to tell me that the Seattle City Council couldn't they have just gone to Amazon and be like, "Hey, look, we have a homeless problem. We'd love your assistance to help. I'll tell you what. We're going to start a program. If you guys would like to donate to it, that'd be fantastic. And in return, when it comes to this new construction project you're planning, we'll cut you some tax incentive breaks to sort of offset the money you can give." I mean, like, get into a partnership mode. Right. I mean, not saying that's a perfect solution, but certainly it's better than taxing every single employee that works there.
And here's the thing. They don't have any idea what they're going to do with this money. They just want the money. The goal of the new tax is simply to raise more money instead of truly solving the homelessness facing our region. That's from an op-ed written by the heads of the Seattle Chamber of Commerce, the Downtown Association, and the Greater Seattle Business Association. They noted that in the past 2 years, Seattle has increased spending on housing and homelessness by 50%, only to see a 37% rise in the homeless population.
Wow. Wow.
They don't have a plan.
No.
They don't know how to fix this problem. All they know how to do is force these businesses to give them more money.
Well, and the only, look, and the best and most viable way to go and deal with the homeless problem, it takes a long time. You know, you need a vibrant economy. You need available jobs. And that's not to say you need available jobs for the homeless to go work at. No, what you need is a vibrant economy where there are jobs available for the individuals that live in that region so that you have people who can go and give and help funnel money into organizations that help homeless people. I mean, that's how you end up solving the problem. One, you stop future homeless people from occurring by making sure there's available jobs for people to go and take. And then you make sure the region has enough money where people can go and actually give to places where they can do, you know, sort of relief efforts when it comes, not relief efforts, but, you know, outreach programs for homeless people.
This tax is clearly targeted just at Amazon too. I don't blame Amazon one bit for resisting the efforts and saying, fine, if you're going to do this, we are no longer going to expand. Of the $75 million that this tax is projected to raise, $20 million of it is expected to come from Amazon alone.
Yep.
They just want $20 million from Amazon.
Don't let Melvin Carter see that.
What a nice way to say thank you for choosing to make Seattle your home. What a nice way to say thank you for all of the benefits that Seattle is enjoying because of Amazon being headquartered there.
Well, and you mentioned it too. The real story is, I mean, the real story, it buried in the story, in my opinion, is the spending increase that you mentioned, right? That spending on homelessness that actually created an increase in the rise of the homeless population. That, to me, is the real story. What have you been doing with the money that hasn't been working and creating more homeless people?
What they've probably been doing is they've probably set up a series of benefits for homeless people that have made it not as burdensome to be homeless.
Yeah.
Which may have attracted more homeless people. That's a phenomenon that does occur.
Yep.
That is not unheard of when you have a very generous social safety net and when you have a lot of services and benefits. People that are in need of those services and benefits, they're going to move to your city.
651-989-5855. Pete Hegseth is going to join us in just a few minutes. We have just enough time to dive into this. Study by Cornell. This comes out of Washington Times. Study by Cornell and the University of Michigan researchers found that those highly concerned about climate change were less likely to engage in recycling and other eco-friendly behaviors than their global warming skeptics. Hey, yes. Yeah. Way to go, Sam. Way to go, Drew. We're saving the planet.
That's right.
We're
doing more than most of the other people out there.
I don't believe in global warming, and I do more than you do. The one-year study broke 600 participants into three groups based on their level of concern. So you had, when it comes to climate change, you had highly concerned, cautiously worried, and skeptical. Where do you think you land? Do you land on skeptical or I know you're not highly concerned.
Yeah, I'd probably be in the skeptical
yeah.
Camp.
I'm not cautiously worried. I'm the skeptical. They need a fourth, very skeptical. Or no, I'm sorry, the fourth denier. And I'll just fall into the denier category. The highly concerned cluster was most supportive of government climate policies, but least likely to report individual level actions, whereas the skeptical opposed policy solutions, but were most likely to report engaging in individual-level pro-environmental behaviors, according to the research. The skeptics were more likely than the highly concerned to recycle, use public transportation, and reusable shopping bags, and buy eco-friendly products. The skeptical people.
Yeah.
Skeptical people, man. The skeptical will inherit the earth.
You know why? Because they're probably just choosing to live their life and their own personal life in a way that, you know, that they can be proud of, in a way that reduces their, minimizes their impact, just because that's how they want to live. Because they think they're saving the planet.
Yep. The paper said this, belief in climate change predicted support for government policies to combat climate change, but did not generally translate to individual-level self-reported pro-environmental behavior. Now, here's what makes me laugh, right? And the Washington Examiner, they say, why? Well, even the researchers were stumped. Although it's possible that skeptics may place more emphasis on personal responsibility than government action. Gee, you think?
You think?
What do you mean, why? It's obvious why. It's clearly obvious why. Those that believe in global warming, it's so much of this, you got to force other people to go and do it. And the government's going to go and fix it. It's like if you just get out of the way. Like if you have to, it's almost as if, Drew, and yeah. I know this sounds wacky, if you got the government like out of the business, by and large, of governing.
Yeah.
You know, and just told people, hey, this is how things kind of need to be, and the efforts that you can make to make sure you have a viable business and to help with the environment. That if you got the government out of the way, then people would be like, well, you know what? We need to make sure we do our part, because if we don't do our part, then nobody will. The global warming believers out there go, well, if we don't do our part, it's okay. The government will force everybody to.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. When you think the government is responsible for fixing a problem, when you believe that the solution lies with government, that the government is, you know, is going to take, is capable and is going to take care of a problem, that relieves you of any responsibility, that abdicates you of any obligation of taking part and being part of the solution. That's the inherent danger and downside of that mindset of always turning to the government to fix a problem.
Right.
Relieves you of any responsibility of changing your behavior at all.
The best thing that could happen for nonprofit outreach organizations was for the government to not go and support them. I've always believed that.
Yeah.
We talked about the homeless problem, right? Stop. You know, because too many people go, well, I don't have to go and donate to this cause because the government's already funneling money into it. So why am I going to go and add more? Because the government's already, if the government wasn't, people would be like, well, I really need to support this cause that I care so much about. Man, you global warming believers, you're killing the planet.
How's it feel?
Yeah.
How's it feel?
How's that feel?
651-989-5855. Pete Hegseth joins us next.
Justin.
Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130 and 103.5 FM. Welcome back to your Tuesday edition of Justice and Drew. Final segment of the show today. I do want to let you know... on tomorrow's show, we will be joined by GOP gubernatorial candidate Mary Giuliani Stevens, her first visit on the show, and we will hopefully have an interview with Candace Owens, who is going to be in downtown Minneapolis today. We will be attending that lunch and are hoping to nab an interview with her before or afterwards.
Joining us, as he does every Tuesday, Fox News' Pete Hegseth. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, gentlemen. Doing well. How are you?
We're doing fine. And you know, there was somebody that was listening to the show yesterday, and was texting me during our discussion in regards to seatbelt safety. I don't know if you wanted to weigh in on that at all, Pete. If you had anything you wanted to mention.
It not only was that me, but I'm currently in a car not wearing my seatbelt as I speak to you.
Wow!
In an undisclosed state, not Minnesota, but maybe it's legal in that state.
You live a dangerous lifestyle, sir. And as we were...
I live a free... It's about living free. And I actually, the more paternalistic my government gets, even on the smallest things, the more frustrated it makes me. You know when you get a new car and it beeps at you if you don't click your seatbelt?
Right.
I dig into the manual of my new car and I find out how to disable it. It's like it's like doing Jenga. It's impossible, but you can do it. And it doesn't beep at me, because when I hear that beeping, it sounds like tyranny to me.
Pete Hegseth, why do you hate safety?
I hate safety as the highest value, as the highest virtue. As we're teaching our kids in first grade how to, you know, recycle and cross the street, but we're not teaching them the Pledge of Allegiance. You know, it's not the most important thing, even though it's important. Of course, I put my kids in seatbelts. You know, I don't put fragile lives at risk, but I should be able to choose to not make that the most important thing. Maybe I don't want my shirt to get wrinkled.
I agree. I agree with you in theory. I wear my seatbelt, but I wear it because there's no harm in it, and it makes it less likely that I'll, you know, get severely injured if I'm in an accident. But I totally disagree with laws that are designed to protect you from yourself. You know, if not wearing a seatbelt put other people at risk, you know, if like driving drunk. Driving drunk puts other people at risk. That's why it's illegal. That's why you go to jail if you do it. Not wearing a seatbelt doesn't put anybody else at risk.
True. I would also note that I sweat a lot and when I wear a seatbelt, it pushes my clothes close to me, and I don't like that. So I don't want a seatbelt. But I agree with you. A first-order effect, if it only affects you, why are you dabbling in my life? But, you know, liberals make the argument, and a lot of squishy Republicans, frankly, that the second-order effect, the cost of my hospitalization is a public cost, and therefore I should be told to wear a seatbelt.
No.
And that becomes the slippery slope. It's the second-order effect they use all the time on safety to impose things on us. It's just like, I would note, just like the, I believe, the liquor laws you were talking about yesterday. Why in the world can it be when it's open or not open?
Right.
And I just don't quite, I understand the reasons why on religious levels at some level. I get it. But at this point, letting people choose makes a lot more sense today.
Well, you know, Drew, what about, you know, the effect that it has on me when I pull up next to Pete Hegseth and I look over and see that, why is this guy not wearing a seatbelt? And now I'm just kidding. Our point yesterday was more to the law abiding portion of it, and that was all.
Let me say this: I did yesterday while I was talking to you guys or texting you guys, but I couldn't talk. I did pull up next to a police officer, and I did slyly buckle my belt because I didn't want a ticket. So, you know, I comply when I have to.
One more quick point on this, and then we'll actually move on to stuff that's relevant. And that is, you hear the argument made, and I'm going to bring in illegal immigration, right? It's like, you know, the no human is illegal. You can't be an illegal citizen. I disagree. And the seatbelt one's a good one. Because if you're driving around in a state that by law requires you to wear a seatbelt, and you're not buckled in while driving, then you are driving around illegal.
That's a great point. Yeah. Just find another way. I am an illegal non-alien.
Right? Yeah. That's right. Yeah. I am driving around in a state of illegality. Same thing when you're speeding.
Yeah. But I'm okay with it. I own that. I wear that title if I have to. And unfortunately, that doesn't always happen.
All right. It may not be illegal, but it does suck. The Iran deal. And President Donald Trump is planned to this afternoon, I believe 1 o'clock our time, he's going to make an announcement on the future of that deal. Expectation? Do you have insight? Do you know? Has the president spoken to you and told you his plans?
No, he has not. I will be watching like you. But I do think the best window into his decision today is probably the people he surrounded himself with recently, from John Bolton to Pompeo. These are fierce and ferocious critics of the Iran deal. I personally think, and in light of the statements he's made recently about what a terrible deal it is, I don't know how another precipice declaring how horrible it is and then delays it, especially because the Europeans haven't delivered on the massive modifications he gave them time to make. So I'm hopeful and believe that at this point that he's going to step up and say, we're tearing it up. And in doing so, we need a better deal. And no matter what, Iran's not going to get a bomb.
Is there any correlation at all with, and I know he's a little early because the deadline on the Iran deal for recertification is the 12th, but we know that Kim Jong-un is in China. The president was tweeting about that this morning. Does the North Korea discussion with China and the U.S. have it? Does that come into play at all with this Iran nuke deal decision? In your opinion?
In my opinion, it shows Iran how serious we are about making sure the deals really matter. Because you can make the argument, why would North Korea, I mean, I'm hearing a lot of people on TV say, why would North Korea enter a deal with us when they see that we just scrapped a deal that was made in a previous administration? That may be part of the view, the way they look at it, but I think they could also look at it as, look at how serious Donald Trump is about the actual internal workings of the deal. So we're not going to get, nothing's going to happen in North Korea as far as de-escalating here and getting a deal unless it's serious and it's substantive. So I actually think it draws him more soberly to the table to realize America means business. And I also think they're very different. I mean, you basically, in North Korea, you're negotiating with one man. I mean, it's Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. Kim Jong-un can make whatever decisions he wants because he's the one man in control of all the power in that country. That creates a lot more opportunities when in Iran you have not a totally free, but a more free, slightly if free people. You've got the Ayatollah in control and more control than the president there. You've got some balance. I mean, I'm trying to hedge here, but there's a little bit. So it's not as simple as just make a deal with one person. And you've got the theocratic part of Iran. So I think Iran is much more complicated making, and this deal, they're so able to cheat on it, and it ends in 10 years, that get rid of it, start over, but you can still do the North Korean one as well.
And you're not just negotiating with Iran. I mean, you've got other countries, you've got European countries that are very involved in that. I made a prediction earlier that, you know, this feels like it's sort of that classic Trump, you know, public negotiation style, where he's being rather bombastic and provocative on social media and with his statements, but behind the scenes, he's probably using that threat of walking away as leverage to get better terms from our European allies, because the European allies are desperately pleading with the United States to not withdraw from the deal.
That's true. I think that is true. But famously, I think it's a 5+1 deal, so five countries plus the UN and Iran came into this whole deal. Well, two of those five countries are Russia and China, and they want instability for the United States. Right now, they've got cozy and convenient relationships on a lot of levels with Iran. So it's just not as straightforward, and I think we have to be willing to do what's in our best interest, working with Europe, the Europeans where we can, because it's either us or Israel is going to stop Iran from a bomb. I want a strike yet. You do it peacefully if you can, but let's be sober about the fact that Iran really, really wants a bomb, and they really, really want a death to America and to wipe Israel off the map. And that has to matter to us, because the history is not over, and we've seen what happens when evil people get evil weapons.
Well, speaking of Israel, story out of Yahoo, not getting a lot of attention due to all the other news going on, but yesterday, workmen put up street signs to the U.S. Embassy due to open in Jerusalem in 1 week. The move was hailed as historic by Israel, loathed by Palestinians, not surprising. They erected the signpost reading U.S. Embassy. They did that in Arabic, Hebrew, and English around the site. Currently a U.S. consular building. And this is breaking decades of U.S. diplomacy and international consensus that President Donald Trump announced back on December 6th, the recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and the transfer of the embassy located until now in Tel Aviv. It's pretty historic.
Absolutely. We overuse the word historic in our time.
Yeah.
This is truly historic. Like, this might be, when you look at the Trump presidency, and we all live through it, so everything feels big, but when history is written about the big movements, this moment of U.S. moving its embassy to Jerusalem, and a shift in the way that we recognize that country and recognize its relations with the Arab world, this is going to be that kind of move. So a lot of stuff happening, but this reorients the whole region. It's crystallized what a threat Iran is. It's crystallized how close we are to Israel. It's made the Sunni Saudi countries closer to Israel because they see Iran as more of a threat than they see Israel. All of that because we made a simple recognition that's been obvious forever, but the swamp technocrats, the civil service folks, refused to do because they were afraid of a few protests. I mean, this is going to be a very interesting week in Jerusalem. And I hope we pay attention to it.
Well, and again, just to kind of double down, you take this with the potential of whatever gets announced of that Iran nuke deal, and what a difference a couple of years can make, you know?
Oh my goodness! And you know what? I mean, it is downright criminal what John Kerry is doing right now, too. By the way, negotiating on the sidelines with the largest state sponsor of terrorism in the world to save a really crappy deal as the former Secretary of State. I mean, someone made this example. I think it was Charlie Hurt in a post in an article yesterday in the Washington Times. He said, imagine if Condoleezza Rice had been traveling to Iraq and Afghanistan in 2008 and 2009, 2010 to save the Iraq war because Barack Obama was about to pull out and, you know, lose the war and give away our gains. Imagine if she had done that, the outrage you would get from the media. I mean, that's the analogy here.
Yeah.
We duly elected a president. He was elected on scrapping a deal. He's going about doing that, and the former Secretary of State is meeting with these foreign leaders to try to undermine our president. I mean, it is terrible stuff, but it is a reflection. You're right of what an amazing difference, refreshing difference on that level this administration has been.
Well, it's just I don't know how this is going to play out in the Middle East, and I don't know if this is the right move. I'm not smart enough, nor do I claim to have enough expertise to know if this truly is the best move. But what I am grateful for is at least we have some semblance of a strategy or a vision when it comes to what the hell we're doing in the Middle East. And for the duration of Obama's presidency, one of my biggest frustrations was I had I never had any idea what his foreign policy strategy or vision was.
Well, that's exactly right. You know what it comes down to? President Trump simply stands by our friends and stands up to our enemy. Whereas under the Obama administration, it's like, wait, we're going to push our friends to the side and try to make friends with our enemies. And everyone's like, well, what is that doing? How does that work? And I don't understand what the goal is here. And it leads to massive, massive confusion. It's the difference between blame America first, which was effectively Barack Obama's approach, and, you know, America first or America leads under Trump. I mean, it's very clarifying. Even if he's not making new stuff up, he's just refortifying existing relationships.
We have about a minute 30 left talking with Pete Hegseth. Just real quick, your thoughts on the some of the comments from John McCain in regards to an invite or a lack of invite, don't come to my funeral. All of this just, in our opinion, we were talking, I don't want to speak for Drew, but we were talking about it earlier. Just it all comes off as really bad with, you know, in these sort of waning days of John McCain.
You know, it is. It feels like sour grapes. This is a guy who... But here's what I have to do with John McCain. I have to step back a decade, and I have to look at the guy that ran on country first. I have to look at the guy who ran to win the Iraq War and fight for the surge. I have to look at a guy who, you know, sat in the Hanoi Hilton for 6 years and refused to leave until all of his men were out. I have to remember someone who's given so much to their country. And now I think he's probably confused. He's confused by a country that elected a man that said that he likes people who weren't captured. You know, I mean, he's at a place where he's kind of befuddled. I wish I'd picked Joe Lieberman. You know, what's happening? I don't like when the anger is an approach at the end. I'm not saying I necessarily understand it, but I've had so much respect for other things he's done in his career that in my case, I'm going to try to choose to remember those moments. And I knew him personally in 07 and 08 when we fought to win the Iraq War. No one else was there. It was John McCain, Joe Lieberman, and Lindsey Graham who stood by the troops and said they could still win in the Iraq surge, which is exactly what happened. So that's it's unfortunate. I wish he wasn't looking at it that way, but that's John McCain I'll choose to remember.
Pete Hegseth, we are out of time. Thank you so much for joining us, and we will catch up with you again next week.
You got it. Take care.
We will certainly be covering whatever President Donald Trump's announcement is later on this afternoon on tomorrow's show, probably starting with Sam's Top 5 at 6:20.
That's right. And gubernatorial candidate, GOP, Mary Juliana Stevens, will be joining the show at 8 o'clock tomorrow. Hopefully have a recorded interview with Candace Owens. Have a wonderful day, everybody.
I'm Chris Addison. Here's